So as you guys heard, I have not much time, but as you guys heard, when I was 13 years old, I was going up for a layup in basketball. Something snapped in my knee. That knee injury triggered every joint in my body to go haywire. So much so that my mom and dad couldn't even recognize their own son. I looked like the Pillsbury Doughboy. Eventually, I was diagnosed with something called Hodgkin's lymphoma, and as a 13-year-old, the doctors gave me 3 months to live. So think about that for a second. 13 years old, on the cusp of my teen years, hormones are kicking in, I'm interested in girls finally. My friends are out chasing those girls, worrying about the coolest hairstyles, the nicest clothes, the nicest shoes. I'm 60 pounds overweight, bald from head to toe, sitting on the bottom of the shower floor, picking chunks of hair out of the drain, crying my eyeballs out. I not only looked death straight in the eye and laughed, but I survived and then thrived. In fact, 1 week after chemo treatment, I ran a 5K race. Not to win, obviously, but just to finish, just to have a goal in mind and to accomplish it. I was in remission for about a year, going in for a regular checkup for that Hodgkin's lymphoma. Doctors found a golf ball-sized tumor on my right lung. And one day they diagnosed... This all happened in 24 hours. In one day, they diagnosed, they saw the tumor, they did a needle biopsy, they took out a lymph node, they put in a Hickman catheter, they cracked open my ribs, took out the tumor, and put in a drainage tube, and started chemotherapy in less than 24 hours. This time around, the doctors diagnosed with a type of cancer that affects 3 out of 1 million people. And still, to this day, the doctors tell me I'm the only person in the world to ever had Hodgkin's and Askin's sarcoma. And the chances of me getting and surviving both of these illnesses, believe it or not, was like winning the lottery 4 times in a row with the same exact numbers. As a 16-year-old, the doctors told me I had 14 days to live. So this time around, things were a little bit worse. 14 days turned into 15 days, which turned into 3 weeks, which turned into a month, 2 months, 3 months. Every time I went in for a treatment, I had about 3 months of intense chemotherapy, an entire month of radiation treatments, and then 10 more months of chemotherapy. And every time I was in the hospital, I'd be in there for 5 days at a time or 4 days at a time, and they put me in a medical-induced coma. I don't remember being 16 years old. But thanks to the miracle of modern medicine, family support, prayer, and just that inner will to keep going, to get out of that hospital, I walked out of the hospital a hairless, happy, bloated young man. Like I said, I not only survived, but thrived. In fact, 1 year after I was placed in remission, I won my high school's league track meet in the 800-meter run. Having these two cancers made me realize a lot about life. It's not about the coolest hairstyles. I'm lucky I have hair. I'm happy I have hair. It's not about the coolest shoes, the nicest clothes. It's about being true to yourself, helping other people, and doing the best you can possibly do every single day of your life. So we'll skip over college because for me it was a $100,000 party. In graduate school, I was studying to be a psychologist for cancer patients. And I think we might have a quick problem, but I'll keep talking. In graduate school, I was studying to be a psychologist for cancer patients. And I figured that I had a lot to offer. I've been through 2 cancers. I could give a lot back and help a lot of people. But I realized it would be too emotional for me, and I would get too attached to the cancer patients, and I couldn't handle losing anyone. I couldn't go in for a Wednesday 1 o'clock appointment and have that 1 o'clock appointment not be there. It would just tear me up. But I knew life was too precious and too short, and I wanted to make a difference in lives of not only cancer patients, but people around the world. And I kept looking and searching, and I thought, I wanted the highest platform in the world to exclaim the potential of the human body and spirit. So my brother and I did some research and found that if I could summit Everest, I'd be the first cancer survivor in history to do so. And I thought, what better platform than the highest mountain in the world to exclaim the potential of the human body and spirit? At the time I was going to grad school, I was actually living in Jacksonville, Florida. And I couldn't exactly train on the 15-foot sand dunes down there. If I was climbing up to 29,000 feet, I think if we just move the cursor off the thing there, yeah. Anyhow, if, like I said, I couldn't exactly train on the 15-foot sand dunes there. So I moved to Estes Park, Colorado. Sight unseen, never been there before in my entire life. Been to Colorado a number of times, but never been to Estes Park. Highest mountain there is about 14,400 feet. That's half the size of Everest. And I'm not talking from the trailhead to the summit. I'm talking from sea level to the summit. And keep in mind, I'm huffing and puffing pretty hard with my one lung carrying 100 pounds of rocks in my backpack. There was a mountain out there called Long's Peak that I would go up once a week. People would go off the mountain when bad weather came in. I would look for the bad weather and go up into it. Once a week at 14,000 over 200 feet high with 100 pounds of rocks in my backpack. The time finally came. I started approaching Everest organizers. Well, pretend you guys organized trips up Everest. I've had two cancers, 3 months to live, 14 days to live. I have one lung, and I've never been any higher than 14,200 feet. There was no way a guide was going to take me up to 29,000 feet. They told me there was no way anyone was going to take a one-lung, two-time cancer-surviving lunatic up the highest mountain in the world. But anyone here ever seen the Everest IMAX movie? A few people, I see some heads nodding, yeah. A guy who organized that, his name was Wang Chu Sherpa. He organized that Everest expedition, took care of every detail. And I figured that if he could organize that expedition, he could surely organize my little expedition. So time came, I had a goal in mind to fly 12 time zones around the world and climb the highest mountain on Earth. I didn't have enough money. I literally sold my entire life savings to follow a dream. I begged, I borrowed, I pleaded, I robbed a couple banks, and eventually made it to Kathmandu, Nepal, where the true adventure begins. I'm not saying that, you know, going through cancer and everything is an adventure, because it definitely is, and it doesn't just pull that person through it, it pulls the entire family through it, as we all know. Speaking of, how many people here know someone touched by cancer? I'd say 99.9% of the people, and some of those other people just got shots in their arms and they can't raise them up. So when I was in Kathmandu, I actually visited a place called the Bhaktapur Cancer Center. And I wish I had the video here, but it's a cancer center in Kathmandu, Nepal, where the doctors told me pretty much every patient would die. They just don't have the right technology, they don't have the right funding, they don't have the right equipment to provide adequate care. But you should have seen how big the patient's eyes got when the doctors told him I was a two-time cancer survivor, which is an unheard-of term over there. You know, it literally took all the strength I had to hold back my tears. The doctor told him, like I said, I was a two-time cancer survivor, and the next day I was leaving to go climb Mount Everest, and I wanted to give them something that represented my life's journey, which is hope. You guys heard the whole saying, I believe the human body can live for about 3 days or 30 days without food. Human condition can sustain itself for about 3 days without water, but no human alive can survive for more than 30 seconds without hope. Because without hope, we truly have nothing. So when I was sick, my dad gave me a shirt that said, I don't always look like this. I'm on chemo. Green shirt, brought it with me, took it to the Bhaktapur Cancer Center, gave it to a fellow who was 14 years old, who was battling Hodgkin's lymphoma, gave it to him and told him it was for good luck, and when he got better, he had to pass it on to someone else for good luck. And I've always wondered what happened to that t-shirt. In fact, I was back in Kathmandu raising funds for the Bhaktapur Cancer Center in October of 2007 and ran into that same doctor. He was still there. And we, you know, sat in his office and started chatting for a while, and there it was. But he wanted me to know And I'm passing this on to you guys to just prove what hope really does to people. He wanted to let me know that the shirt had been passed on to over 30 different survivors. So to get to Everest Base Camp, you have to fly into a little village called Lukla. And if we get this up in time, it's a really cool clip. You fly into Lukla, and you're actually landing on an airstrip that's at an angle like this. And it went under the Himalaya Mountains, and at the other end's a cliff. And I kid you not, it makes you feel really good when you look out the window and see old fuselages laying at the bottom. So we got into Lukla, and I thought, okay, I can make it here, no problems. Getting up to Everest Base Camp is about 60 miles away. Hey, look at that. Maybe we can check out the video. Just no video. Is it on there?
Yeah, it should be here. Hit the, it's because of the video.
Yeah. I tried that. There we go. This should might work. This should, nope. Okay. Okay, anyhow. Like I said, it's about 50 miles away. And you have to take your time. And the reason you have to take your time is because the higher you go in altitude, the less atmospheric pressure there is in your body. If you go too high, too fast, a lot of us are doctors here, a lot of you guys are doctors, sorry, you could succumb to high-altitude pulmonary edema or high-altitude cerebral edema. Basically, to sum these two up, cerebral edema, you go too high, too fast, your brain swells, you pass out and die. Pulmonary edema, you go too high, too fast, all this fluid collects in your lungs and you drown on your own fluid. So you want to take your time getting up there. We went through little villages. We got those up there. We went from Lukla to Pakding, and since we're in a hurry, Pakding to Namche Bazaar, Namche to Tommy, Tommy to Namche, Namche to Kumjung, Kumjung to Debeche, Debeche to Dingbeche, Dingbeche to Chikung, Chikung to Lobeche, Lobeche to Gorshep, and Gorshep to Base Camp. Everest Base Camp, situated at 17,500 feet. Was going to be my home for the next month and a half on a glacier that moves 4 feet a day. Okay. Month and a half on a glacier moving 4 feet a day. Day one, day two, day three. How far down would I be when I have to actually go up the mountain? I actually picked up my tent and moved it back to where it originally was halfway through the expedition. A lot of people wonder, you know, what are those flags up there? And a lot of people say, well, why are you hanging your laundry out there? Like I said, they're flags. They're Tibetan and Buddhist prayer flags blessed by the Lama that protect the climbers in the camp, made of silk, flapping in the wind, and every little strand that gets tattered off is a prayer floating to Buddha. And before you climb the mountain, you have to go through a puja ceremony. They believe the mountain is a goddess. They call it Sagarmatha or Chomolungma, which literally means Mother Goddess of the Earth. So you have to go through a ceremony to get permission from the mountain to climb. And I'm sitting at base camp thinking to myself, okay, I just flew 12 time zones around the world, took 2 days to get here and 14 days hiking up here. What if the mountain says no? Yeah, we go through this whole ceremony and the mountain says, well, yeah, thanks for coming, Sean. Sorry, can't climb. So I lean over to my Sherpa friend. I'm like, well, does this ever happen? Oh, it happens all the time. I'm like, great, what do? He goes, well, what you do is you have a new ceremony, you find a new llama, you pay that llama more money. The mountain magically says yes. So we had our ceremony, mountain said yes, and we started climbing. To get to the summit actually takes, like I said, about a month and a half. And the reason it takes a month and a half is, unlike getting to base camp, you can't just slowly go up the mountain. You have to go up and down the mountain, acclimatizing, getting your body used to the altitude. So we would go up from base camp to the top of the ice fall, back to base camp. And every time we would go back to base camp, we would rest. It could be a day, it could be 2 days, it could be a weekend. It would all depend on how our bodies would react to the altitude, much like going through chemo and treatment. You know, you have a treatment here, and you have to rest and get your counts up before you go through another cycle. So every time we would go back to base camp, it would be our home. We would rest until our bodies were used to the altitude again. So we went from base camp to the top of the ice fall, back to base camp. Base camp up to camp one night, back to base camp. Rested. Base camp up to camp 1, one night back to base camp. Base camp up to camp 2, two nights back to base camp. Base camp up to camp 2, two nights back to base camp. Base camp up to camp 2, two nights just below camp 3 back to base camp. Base camp up to camp 2, two nights back to base camp. Base camp up to camp 2, two nights up to camp 3 back to base camp. So by the time we're ready to climb this stupid thing, we've done it 15 times. With our minds ready to handle the altitude and our bodies ready to handle a summit push, we'll begin on May 11th, 2002, when our goal was to go from base camp up to camp 2, two nights, up to camp 3, and onto the summit. Actually, leaving base camp is very emotional. And it's emotional and dangerous because once you leave base camp and get up over the Khumbu Icefall, there's no visual communication with anyone. If something happens, you're on your own. Helicopters can't fly that high because there's nothing for the blades to bite into. And in my family, it's just my brother, myself, my mom, and my dad. And normal Everest expeditions can consist of about 30 different people. Guides, porters, Sherpas, everything. I had a cook at base camp, my brother at base camp, two Sherpas, and myself. First section we went through was the most dangerous, the Khumbu Icefall. Now, if you can picture, well, take your river out here. Flash freeze it, move it 4 feet a day at a 45-degree angle with chunks of ice the size of the Empire State Building. You have to navigate your way around basically the city of Chicago frozen and all jumbled up. A lot of times you can't go into crevasses and across them and back up. You can't jump across them because they're too big. And you can't go around them. How many people here are afraid of heights? Quite a few arms got up there. And then some people who are just like, I don't want someone to know. A lot of times you have to put ladders across these things. All right, who's in? Who wants to go? Nice, there's a few people. You can talk to me afterwards because I'm taking a group up Kilimanjaro in August. Camp 1, situated at 19,000 feet, was our storage area. It was our emergency camp. Western Khum, temperatures got up to 115 degrees. People have been out in Colorado skiing in the wintertime. You get in the sun, there's no wind. It's warm. Put yourself at 20,000 feet. Largest crevasse we had to cross that year was 5 aluminum ladders tied together. Now, we're all intelligent people here, and we know that if you tie aluminum ladders together, it's not exactly sturdy, and it's not exactly safe, and when you're in the middle of this thing, and it's bowed, and you're going across, the energy from your legs as you're stepping on the ladder, you know, you have a cadence. It starts getting in the ladder. Ladder starts bouncing up and down. Not exactly fun. So where are those hands that were up that said, I'm in? There's one hand raised again. Camp 2 is situated at 21,000 feet, higher than anything in North America, where we ran into an infamous Everest snowstorm. I spent 2 nights holding up the frame of my tent, praying that I wouldn't die. Eventually, we moved up to Camp 3, which was on the side of the Lhotse ice face, which is a sheet of ice at a 45-degree angle, where if you took one wrong step, you would tumble 3,000 or 4,000 feet into a crevasse, where I actually lost one of my good climbing friends. So I don't have any pictures of that, but I do have pictures of Camp 4. 26,000 feet high. There are only 14 mountains in the world above 26,000 feet. It's known as the death zone, because the higher you go in this altitude, the more you spend in this altitude, the more your body dies. Brain cells start dying, muscle melts away, fat melts away, your body deteriorates above 26,000 feet. So our goal was to get here and to actually leave at around 1, or just to get there around 1 o'clock, take a nap, leave it around 8 or 9 p.m., head on up through the night, and summit around 9 or 10 in the morning the next day. I slept through my alarm clock. Looking up at the side of the mountain, I was 2 hours behind every other person. Anyone here read the book Into Thin Air by John Krakauer? It's actually about the disaster in 1996 where 13 people died on the mountain because there's a section called the Hillary Step where only one person can go up and one person can go down at the same time. And there was a bottleneck there, and people missed their turnaround time. And about 13 people died just that one day. And I thought to myself, okay, this is exactly what's going to happen to us. So I called my brother on the radio and said, okay, I better get going. And I was a little nervous taking off from Camp 4 until I got to basically the summit ridge. And one thing I want to share with you guys before I wrap up, I was on a knife ridge that was literally probably 3 or 4 feet wide. And the sun was coming up on my right. The most beautiful sunrise I'd ever seen in my entire life. Most beautiful pink, purple, blue, oranges, reds, a sea of clouds with island peaks in the middle. Thinking to myself, this is the most magical moment of my entire life. Until I looked off to my left, and I kid you not, at eye level were stars. I was up so high that I could see the horizon. The sun was coming up, was actually curved, and at eye level on my left were stars. So we made it up to the summit ridge, the infamous Hillary Step, the South Summit. At 9:32 in the morning on May 16th, 2002, I became the first cancer survivor in history to set foot on top of the world. But I wasn't alone. Every single person who's affected by cancer in any way was up there with me. I took a flag, it's about this big, that had names of people touched by cancer, giving me hope, giving me inspiration, and I left it forever commemorating the struggle of cancer patients worldwide. So we have a saying in the climbing industry that climbing is a round-trip sport, summiting is optional, returning is mandatory. So a true expedition isn't over until you get back to base camp, safe and sound. People young and old get cancer. Everyone does the right thing to get over it. Unfortunately, some people don't make it. One of the reasons you're here, whether you were forced in buying a ticket or your spouse dragged you here, one of the reasons you're here is to help support that research. Like I said before, thank you for my life. And for the countless people that you're going to help, thank you for saving their lives. Having these two cancers made me realize a lot of things about life. And one thing I want to share with you guys is, you know, I don't know why I'm alive. I really don't. By all medical terms, over, I should be dead. But I'm incredibly grateful for the third life that I've been given. And I'm committed to shouting from the rooftops of the world that there is hope, that miracles exist up and down whatever mountains you guys are climbing in your lives. And one thing I want to share with you guys before the auction starts is that going through cancer taught me what I'm going to teach you right now, is that we should not worry about dying. We shouldn't worry about dying, but we should worry about not living a life that matters. So with that said, you guys are here for a purpose and a reason, and I thank you for being here. Thank you.